This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the September 13th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Monday, September 11th, was the 16th anniversary of the attacks on New York World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and, as in every year since 2001, somber tributes to those who died that day took place at Ground Zero in Washington and across the country. If at any of these ceremonies a word was said or there was a moment of silence asked for the millions who have been killed, wounded, or made refugees by the actions of the United States in response to those attacks, I'm not aware. That's something that concerned U.S. General Stanley McChrystal when he took over as the commander of the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan in June 2009. I believe the perception caused by civilian casualties is one of the most dangerous enemies we face, he said at the time. Unfortunately, the past 8 years have shown McChrystal had nothing to worry about. Civilian casualties caused by U.S. troops more recently, be they in Iraq and assisting Iraqi forces in the retaking of Mosul from ISIS, in Syria where 978 civilians have reportedly been killed in the past 3 months, or providing tactical support for Saudi Arabia in its continuing air war on cholera-ridden Yemen seems to have attracted little attention from the public. When it comes to the war in the greater Middle East, maybe we're the bad guys. Those aren't my words, but those of U.S. Army Major Danny Sherson from the title of his recent article on the Tom Dispatch website titled, Worth Dying For? When it comes to the war in the greater Middle East, maybe we're the bad guys, which is particularly significant because Sherson remains on active duty, stationed at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas, after having served tours of duty in both Afghanistan and Iraq. Keep in mind, he writes, that the war for the greater Middle East is just the latest adventure in the depressing annals of Washington's geostrategic thinking since President Ronald Reagan's administration, along with the Saudis and Pakistanis, armed, funded, and supported extreme fundamentalist Afghan Mujahideen rebels in a Cold War struggle with the Soviet Union that eventually led to the 9/11 attacks, end quote. A remarkable statement from Major Danny Sherson on an off-duty and on-duty member of the military service, from whom you will hear even more at 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that. As for 9/11, mere mention, let alone discussions or debates over questions that remain about the attack and the government's official narrative that I have covered on past programs, remain off-limits for the mainstream and its alternative equivalents, much as has been the case with the assassination of President Kennedy. Whether one accepts or not the official narrative, isn't that curious? There's little, if any, notice that the men planning the 9/11 attacks have been sitting in cages in Guantanamo for more than a decade without apparently any plan by the government to bring them to trial. On the potential war fronts, and where would we be without them, North Korea, a country which the U.S. Air Force literally decimated 65 years ago, was subjected to more U.N. sanctions on Monday for continuing to develop its nuclear weapons program despite threats from Washington that include the option of a preventive military strike. What triggered the U.N. move was the North's sixth and largest nuclear test this month. It was the ninth resolution unanimously adopted by the 15-member Security Council over North Korea's ballistic missile and nuclear programs since 2006. In order to get another unanimous vote, the U.S. was obliged to soften the original resolution to avoid a Russian or Chinese veto. Thus, Washington had to be content with banning North Korea's textile exports, capping fuel supplies, and prohibiting North Koreans from working in other countries. Since China ships its oil to the North through a pipeline, the resolution will have little effect on its fuel supplies. Preventing North Koreans from working abroad will be difficult to enforce, since most of them, almost 50,000, work in either China or Russia. Others can be found in a multitude of countries across Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. According to a 2012 report by the International Network for the Human Rights of North Koreans Overseas Labor, Pyongyang takes in between 1.2 and 2.3 billion annually from their labor. The biggest story that emerged from the UN vote was the escalating threats against China on the part of Washington. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin warned China that if it did not follow through on the new sanctions, the U.S. would, quote, put additional sanctions on them and prevent them from accessing the U.S. and international dollar system, end quote. An unnamed senior administration official told Reuters any such, quote, secondary sanctions on Chinese banks and other companies were on hold for now to give China time to show it was prepared to fully enforce the latest and previous rounds of sanctions. Asked if Trump was considering cutting off Chinese banks from the U.S. financial systems, White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders said, all options are on the table. The president has also said that he wants every country involved to step up and do more. This, she said, was a small step in that process, and we're hoping that they'll take a greater role and more active role in putting pressure on North Korea, end quote. Washington, notes the Reuters article, has so far mostly held off on new sanctions against Chinese banks and other companies doing business with North Korea, given fears of retaliation by Beijing and possibly far-reaching effects on the world economy. That's putting it mildly. China currently holds $1.24 trillion of U.S. debt in the form of bills, notes, and bonds, which constitute 30% of our foreign debt. Moreover, the U.S. is heavily dependent on the importation of Chinese products, particularly in the construction industry. For the first 7 months of 2017, the trade deficit between the two countries was just under $205 billion in Chinese favor, an average of slightly more than $29 billion per month, just above the monthly figure for the last year of the Obama administration. In other words, Washington's tough talk over China is purely for public consumption. Meanwhile, the war of words continues against Iran, with President Trump openly looking for an excuse to withdraw the U.S. from the deal negotiated last year by Secretary of State John Kerry with Tehran, with the backing of the other four permanent members of the U.N. Security Council and Germany. While the agreement lifted international sanctions against Iran for its agreeing to cut back its nuclear enrichment program for 10 years, it had no effect on the sanctions against Tehran that had been approved by Congress on the urging of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and its lobby AIPAC, the only agency representing the interests of a foreign government not required to register as a foreign agent. On September 5th, Nikki Haley, Trump's U.N. representative and an outspoken critic of Iran and the agreement, spoke about the subject before the American Enterprise Institute, a longtime bastion of the nation's neocons. Next month, she told her audience, President Trump will once again be called upon to declare whether he finds Iran in compliance with the terms of the deal. It should be noted, she added, this requirement to assess compliance has not come from the deal itself. It was created by Congress in the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, also known as the Corker-Cardin Law. That's a very important distinction to keep in mind, she said, because many people confuse the requirements of the deal with the requirements of U.S. law. I'm not going to prejudge in any way what the president's going to decide next month, Haley said. While I've discussed it with him, I do not know what decision he will make. It's his decision to make and his alone. And then she proceeded to not only trash the deal, but deny the legitimacy of Iran as a nation. The Islamic Republic of Iran was born in an act of international law breaking, she said. On November 4, 1979, a group of Islamic revolutionary students overran the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. In violation of international law, they held 52 American Marines and diplomats hostage for 444 days. For the 38 years since, she went on, the Iranian regime has existed outside the community of law-abiding nations. Henry Kissinger famously said, she reminded the audience, that Iran can't decide whether it is a nation or a cause. Since 1979, the regime has behaved like a cause, she continued. The cause is spreading revolutionary Shiite Islam by force. Its main enemy and rallying point has been and continues to be what's called the Great Satan, the United States of America, end quote. No mention by Haley, of course, about the CIA coup against the elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953 that installed the Shah on his peacock throne. No mention that the U.S. had backed Saddam Hussein and provided Iraq with the material to manufacture chemical weapons that he would be used in the war on Iran following the Shah's overthrow. and no credible evidence of Iran spreading revolutionary Islam by force because no such evidence exists. Soon after the revolution, Haley told her audience, the Iran Revolutionary Guards was created to protect the revolution from foreign and domestic enemies, and soon after its creation, the IRGC founded Hezbollah to spread Iran's influence and revolution abroad, end quote. Not so. The IRGC was founded as part of the new Iranian government in 1979. Hezbollah arose in Lebanon in 1983, 4 years later, as an indigenous resistant movement to Israel's occupation following its brutal invasion the previous June. No matter, after 1988, she claims, quote, under the IRGC's direction, Hezbollah then expanded its lethal reach to Europe, Africa, Asia, and the Americas in search of victims to kill. Actually, what Hezbollah was doing at the time was escalating its resistance to Israeli occupation. This bore fruit in 2000 when, bowing to Israeli public pressure, the Israeli army was forced to withdraw troops back across the border. Well, today, Haley insisted, Hezbollah is doing the Iranian regime's dirty work supporting the war crimes of Syria's Assad, and is building an arsenal of weapons and battle-hardened fighters in Lebanon in preparation for war, end quote. Well, even the mainstream media has reported that Hezbollah has been battling ISIS and the al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra from the time it entered the fighting in Syria, but curiously, there's not a single reference to either ISIS or al-Qaeda in Haley's entire speech. In her presentation at the American Enterprise Institute, Haley literally blamed every attack on U.S. forces in the region over the past 30 years on Iran, directly or indirectly, including, quote, the thousands of American men and women who were wounded or killed in Iraq. Haley's attacks at Hezbollah coincided with the beginning of the Israeli army's largest drill in 20 years near the Lebanese border that encompasses ground, air, sea forces, and intelligence operations. The drill, which will be overseen by the Israel Defense Forces Northern Command, was expected to last about 10 days. It was to include a scenario of instant escalation in which the Israeli army has to defend Israel against multiple terrorist infiltrations in the north. Well, the purpose of the drill is to test the fitness of the Northern Command and the relevant battalions during an emergency, said a top IDF officer. In the drill scenario, the cabinet tells the armed forces to vanquish Hezbollah. And quote, as I understand it, the state in which Hezbollah either has no ability to do or desire to attack anymore, end quote, explained the officer. The Israeli military is still smarting from the last time it engaged Hezbollah. In a month of fighting during the summer of 2006, the invading Israeli army was not only repulsed but humiliated to the point where the Army Chief of Staff, Dan Halutz, was forced to resign soon afterward. Israel's Air Force, however, provided to Tel Aviv at U.S. taxpayers' expense, was able to kill over 1,000 Lebanese and destroy a considerable amount of its infrastructure, as well as whole apartment blocks in Beirut, as it had done in 1982, for which Hezbollah had no answer but to continue firing rockets into Israel. In recent months, The Israeli press has run numerous articles about the coming war with Hezbollah as if it was a hurricane and its arrival inevitable. It may well be that this time around the difference in competence between the Hezbollah fighters who have become battle-hardened in Syria and the Israeli soldiers who have been patrolling the West Bank as occupiers with no one shooting at them is likely to be even more glaring than it was in 2006. Finally, if something seems too good to be true, invariably it isn't. An article appeared in the Washington Free Beacon, a neocon giveaway paper in Washington, D.C., noting that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was going to ask Israel to return $75 million to the U.S. Treasury because it had violated the terms of the agreement made last year between President Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in which, in exchange for a record $38 billion gift of U.S. weaponry over the current decade, or $3.8 billion annually, Israel would agree not to ask Congress for additional funding. Well, did anyone expect Netanyahu to keep his word? Of course not. But would Washington make him give back the extra $75 million? Not if Congress had anything to say about it. On Monday, the White House announced the Trump administration will not stand in the way of the additional defense assistance funding to Israel added by Congress and won't hold Israel to its pledge to return such funds. Said R.C. Hammond, a State Department spokesman, to Fox News, the administration is committed to ensuring Israel receives the assistance that has been appropriated by Congress. Well, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham pushed the appropriation of the extra funding because he was furious at the terms of the Memorandum of Understanding negotiated by the Obama administration. A photo accompanying the story showed a smiling Graham sitting at a table with Republican billionaire megadonor Sheldon Adelson on his right and Democratic billionaire and megadonor Haim Saban on his left. Both men have an arm around Graham. He is their boy. And now, a word from AIPAC.
That's where AIPAC comes in. AIPAC has worked with Congress for decades to counter economic warfare against Israel. In the 1970s, we helped Congress combat the Arab League boycott by preventing American companies from complying. That boycott ultimately failed. In the 2000s, we urged Congress to make ending boycotts against Israel a condition of free trade with the United States. The Arab states of Oman and Bahrain agreed, and America now monitors their compliance. And today, we are succeeding again. As trade talks take place between the United States and the European Union, strong bipartisan majorities in Congress have set a clear standard. EU nations boycotting Israel risk forfeiting the benefits of free trade with America. This wouldn't happen without you, your support for AIPAC, and your commitment to advancing the U.S.-Israel alliance.
Indeed. That's from AIPAC, which gives Congress its marching orders on Israel's behalf. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.